Okay. I want to just conclude the points we were making last week and then move on to the next level of this discussion. Again, last week we were trying to show why our Masoiris, our Kabbalah, our tradition, is solid enough, logical, irrefutable basis for the truth of our religion. And where I think we got to last week, and Erlam will correct me if I'm wrong, was basically showing how the possibility of the Torah having been introduced to the Jewish people at some point in history after Matan Torah is basically completely impossible and inconceivable from a purely logical perspective. Without getting back into all the details now, I just want to tie it up with a couple of more points. So first of all, we said last week, that if you go back to the time, if you narrow down the time frame within which the Torah could have been introduced, which obviously was before it was translated to Greek, you're left with a very narrow time frame. But the truth is that it's even narrower than that, because the tradition, Jewish tradition, is so tight with the times that we have from the beginning of Bria Sa'ilam straight until, well, we don't need it to reach our time, but for our purposes right now, until the end of the Gemara, okay, which is well after the Torah was translated into Greek, a very, very tight timetable of events, times, people, basically spreading around the whole nation. And therefore, when we were talking about the possibility last week of maybe in that about 300, 400 year time frame that we came up with, maybe somebody came and convinced the entire Jewish nation that this was something that all of their forefathers had had a couple of hundred years ago, but they all completely, it stopped completely, they all forgot about it, only I have it left, nobody of the millions of Jews has any historic trace left of these things, and now he's introducing it, and he has the entire Jewish people accept it at once. The truth is, it's even more than that, because the Messiah provides us with dates all the way back, a tight date schedule, which would mean that he would actually be telling these people, you're unaware of events that happened within the last 50-100 years. There's no life, there's no generation that skipped. If you go through the Torah, from the beginning of the Torah down till the end of Tanakh, and continuing through the Maseiros of Teresh Baal Peh, right? Tanakh ends with the beginning of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Then you continue from there to Shimon HaTzadik and down through the chain. No generation is skipped, and in almost all generations, you have a whole spread of people being presented. So where would a person be able to come along and say, each generation knew the generation immediately before them who were actually keeping the Torah? Unless someone suddenly came and said, yeah, well, people that you all knew, who died not so long ago, were all keeping this Torah. So basically, the only point I'm trying to make here is that the time frame really is too tight. And not only that, the way the Torah presents is so generous with all kinds of different details that can mamish mess up anybody who's trying to present this as a new innovation. For example, all over the place, the Torah is giving physical monuments of events that happened. Right? There's Kever Rachel. And there's the pile of stones by Achan's grave. And there's the stones that they put in the Yarden, right after they passed. The Maras HaMachpelah, right? The Torah all over the place is noting. There's this here until today, it's that way. This is that way until today. This is here, this is there. A person is coming along and presenting a Torah to the Jewish people at some later stage in history, and he's explaining to them about all these sites all around the land where they've been living, are actually from? Okay, this is really just adding a couple of...
Do you know where these pilots and stones are today?
What's that?
Do you know where these pilots and
stones
are?
Like, no. Today we don't know where it is anymore. At that time. Meaning, for example, if he's coming and saying... Well, first of all, some of them we do. We have... Ma'arat ha-Machpelah, Kever Rachel, etc., etc. But even these other ones, we're being told, it's written in the Navi that they're there Ad Hayom Hazeh, which would mean, whenever he was introducing them, he's saying, it was there until pretty recently. Okay. Just one other point also to consider is, that if somebody is coming and inserting the Torah at some point in Jewish history, how do you account for lineage? How do you account for the fact that today we know that there are Kehanim, Levim, Yisraelim? He's presenting a Torah that says, he made it up. The children of Aaron were designated as Kehanim. Now what did he do? Went among all of Klal Yisrael and designated which families should now be considered Kehanim and explained to them that they actually come from that same lineage? There's no way to really account for the fact that until today, even though today it's a bit vaguer, we know for a fact that in earlier times it was very clear who Kehanim are, who Levim, who Yisraelim are, when could that have been introduced? Even more than that, Josephus writes, just want to read a little bit of Josephus, because also just to really highlight exactly how tight the Masoret always was. We Jews yield to the Greeks as to the eloquence of composition, meaning we grant the Greeks that they're better writers than us. Fine. But we give them no such preference as to the verity of ancient history. When it comes to accuracy in recording ancient history, they're nowhere near us. Our forefathers committed that matter to their high priests and to their prophets, and these records have been written all along down to our times with the greatest accuracy. Our forefathers not only appointed the best of these priests and those that attended upon the divine worship for that design from the beginning, meaning for the purpose of keeping track of the Seder Hadoiris, etc., but also made provision that the stock of the priests should continue unmixed and pure. For one who participates in the priesthood, now listen to this, one who participates in the priesthood must propagate of a wife whose genealogy is taken from the ancient tables and can procure many witnesses to it. Meaning Josephus is recording that in his time, when a kohen wanted to marry, in order to register in the Misrad HaPnim, okay, to get his Latin marriage license, his wife had to produce a record of her lineage, which had witnesses testifying to it, many witnesses, he said. How exactly it works, I don't know. But this is Josephus, this is already called recordable history, meaning that he's saying that the Jewish people kept records of their lineage. You're going to say that this is a nation that suffered a lapse of historic memory? They had exact traces of their lineage going all the way back. People were kosher to kahuna. In order for any kohen to marry, his shidduch had to be able to show her lineage going all the way back. Now listen to this. This is our practice not only in Judea, but wherever any group of our nation lives. And even there, an exact catalogue of our priests' marriages is kept at Egypt, Babylon, or in any place of the earth where our priests are scattered. For they sent to Jerusalem the ancient names of their parents in writing. You see how far back the Masoret of Kahuna goes. As well as the names of their more remote ancestors. And they say also who are the witnesses. You think that these things are not provable. Well, if they weren't provable, you had a problem. You couldn't marry Kahuna. The strongest argument, Josephus continues. By the way, I just want to put it to perspective. No, he had to trace his yichus in order to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. But she had to trace her yichus in order to be able to marry a kohen. What's that? A woman had to be of completely pure lineage in order to marry a kohen. Not just Jewish, but that there was no chalolus or mamzerus anywhere along the way. It was a big deal. You see in Shas, in the Gemara, even after the Churban, It was a big deal. Marrying into kahuna was a big deal. It was a complicated bureaucratic business. What's that? Today, everything, unfortunately, is a little... We lost track of things. We don't have these records anymore. Now, listen to this. The strongest argument of our exact management in this manner, again, think of this against the backdrop of our possibility that someone came and introduced it at some point. The strongest argument of our exact management in this matter is that we have the names of our high priests from father to son set down in our records for the period of 2,000 years. This is Josephus talking. Almost 2,000 years ago. If any have transgressed these rules, they are forbidden to present themselves at the altar or to partake of any other of our purifications. Okay? And now he adds, this is necessarily done because everyone is not permitted of his own accord to be a writer. Meaning, we want to make sure that there aren't going to be anyone, just everybody coming along and writing whatever they are dreaming up. Nor is there any disagreement in what is written, and only prophets have written original and earliest accounts of things as they learned them from God Himself by inspiration. For we do not have an innumerable multitude of books disagreeing from one another as the Greeks have. For during so many ages as they have already passed, no one has been so bold as to either add anything to them, or to take anything to them, or to make any changes in them. What's that? Tanakh, and also whatever records the Jewish people kept. Meaning the records of Yichus, etc. And now, another point of the way we treated our Masaira. Another excerpt from Josephus. The chief interest of our people is to educate their children well. Let's note, today that's not a chiddush. Today, education is a universal value. But let's remember that up till as recently as 500 years ago, common folk were illiterate. It was basically at the time of the Renaissance that everybody started reading and writing. The children started going to school. Also, couldn't have been much more than a few hundred years ago. I don't know exactly what the history is. But by us, today, talk about school. Okay, yeah, Jews always sent their kids to school. Okay, there's a given because we grow up in such a society today. We were sending our kids to school. We were educating our children. We were making sure that every last kid was literate hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years before anybody else got to that. Which means that from time beginning, we considered it of utmost value to make sure every child had access to the Masorah. This is not the style of a person who's trying to sell things. The chief interest of our people is to educate their children well. Again, this is a big chiddush when he wrote this. And we think it to be the most necessary business of our whole life to observe the laws that have been given to us and to keep those rules of piety that have been delivered down to us. This is just, again, giving us a little bit of a picture. In other places, he contrasts this to the way it worked with the Goyim. All kinds of conflicting reports of what went on at different times. And the easy way in which they switched lifestyles and traditions. And this is our Messiah. Now, okay, that's really still on the subject of last week. And one last point that I just want to address is a question that was raised by Abnoach this week, which is actually a question that the Bible critics like to pick on. And they say, yes, the Torah was introduced to Klal Yisrael at one point in history. And we know exactly when. It says it in Tanakh. It says in Tanakh that in the time of Yeshio was the son of Amoy, was the son of Menashe. After a bit of not very chashev yichus, a Sefer Torah was discovered in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Everybody got all excited. They read it for the king, and it said all kinds of curses, and they didn't know what's going to be, and they went to Chula. Whatever it is, they say, oh, Sefer Torah was discovered. You see, at least that there was a break in the Masoros. A very big part of our argument was that it was a tight, tight, unbroken chain. See, it was a break in the Masaira. So they found their hole. Bible critics found their hole. Therefore, yes, it was invented by the Kaihanim of that time. But again, like many other things, the same as we've seen with Christianity and with Islam, these are things that sound good on the surface, maybe, but they come with a lack of bothering to analyze Tanakh carefully before making these claims. So let's see, for example, again, even if we'll make that claim, you can claim it for the Torah. But we have Tanakh, right? They didn't discover Sefer Yeshua, Sefer Shoftim, etc. These things were recorded by, that we know, the time of Yeshua. Sefer Yeshua was recorded by Yeshua. Sefer Shoftim was recorded by Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel was recorded by Nosan HaNavi, David in his court. These were things that they handed down. The problem is that all of these sources are full of quotes from the Torah and evident as could possibly be that the Torah was in full practice all throughout this period. Just one, a couple of examples. Throughout Tanakh, what's the most common epithet, the most common name calling used in Tanakh? Anybody? Orel. Orel. That was the derogatory term used in Tanakh. Arelim, Asher lo yivnei Yisrael heima. Right? Shimshon's parents ask him, how would you think of taking a daughter of Arelim? That's number one. But there's so much more than that. Arei Miklat were in existence, right? Did they first initiate the Arei Miklat then when the Yishios? Arei Miklat were standing realities. The fact that, why were Chatzi Shevet Menashe, Reuven, Gad, and half of Shevet Menashe outside on the other side of the Yad? Lamaisa, we don't have to go that far. The Nevi'im are full of verbatim quotes from the Torah. Yeshua, in Sefer Yeshua, there's a whole Perek of Dalit, a whole verbatim quote from the Torah. Yeshua is referring to the Torah all the time. And earlier in history, when King Yoyachas was killed, he was assassinated. Standard practice in those days was, someone assassinates the king, they wipe out the whole family. Amatzia didn't do that. Why? The Navi itself quotes Sefer Teras Moshe, which says, Lohim Subanim Alovos. Right? Torah is busy being quoted from way before Yeshua came around. Yeshua gave the brachas on our grizim and our evil. Why? Like it says in Teras Moshe. They took the bodies of the Canaanite kings off the trees. They hung them up on trees when they defeated the Canaanites. They took them down that day. Why? To fulfill what it says in the Torah. Kalev talks about the story of the Meraglim. Etc., 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 etc. We don't have to... What's that? Yeah. So, the truth is that we don't have to spend too much time on this point. It should be obvious to anybody who's a little familiar with Tanakh. Just we'll explain what actually did happen at the time of Yeshua. What happened at the time of Yeshua was that they found a Torah from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu that had been hidden away. That was what they got excited about. And what they got especially saw as significant was the fact that when they opened it up to read from it, it opened up exactly to the Teichos. That was the whole big commotion that was engendered there. Besides, just look at the story of Minei Obey. What did they do when they found it? They went to Chulda, the Nevi'ah. What was she based on? What tradition was she based on if there was no tradition before that? Yirmiyahu HaNavi was alive at that time. What were they busy doing? Okay. That's that. We can really kind of consider that parenthetic. The main discussion that I wanted to get onto tonight is really what I'm going to the next level of this discussion. This was all really just tying up what we've been talking about up till now. But the next level of this discussion is just to show, we've already seen last week and the other weeks, how the Torah makes it clear that it wants to be based, Hashem wants the Torah to be based on the tradition of the live experiences of our people. Which, as we've been seeing, is irrefutable evidence of the truth of those events. Now let's see the measures that the Torah took to make sure that this is done right. What are the means that the Torah provided us with to ensure that now, thousands of years later, we can know that yes, this was the very same Torah given then at Har Sinai and passed Midor Lidor. So, the famous gimmick with this sort of thing is to draw on the idea of the broken telephone game. You want to ensure the tradition passed pure and unadulterated all throughout the generations. How can you know that? Or, how can you set it up in the first place that it's going to work? So we'll talk broken telephone. You know the name broken telephone? You have a line of kids sitting, 10 kids sitting in a row. The first kid whispers something into the next kid's ear. And by the time he whispers it into the next kid's ear, and it's always amusing to hear what the 10th kid says. That's a common game which basically shows the problem with relying on tradition. How is it going to pass accurately from one generation to the next? And now we'll see the means that the Torah took to make sure that it does work. We'll also understand a lot of the things that we're doing today. So first of all, let's just focus on that game. No, we're just going to talk about the game broken telephone. We're talking about a person who's taking 50 kids and wants to ensure that the word that is said to the first kid will be the same word that the last kid says. A, he wants to ensure that that will happen. B, he wants to have the means of making sure. When I check with the last kid, how can I know that that really was the word that the first kid said? You get it? We're approaching it from two angles. First of all, when I'm dealing with the first kid, how can I make sure that I'll get to the 50th kid straight? Secondly, if someone else comes and asks the 50th kid, how can he be sure that that's the word that the first kid said? So listen to a couple of measures that we can implement. And the Olam will do this together. The Olam will tell me if after everything we're going to go through now, how much money can we put down on that yes, that first word we'll get all the way through. So first of all, here's the first measure we'll take. When we approach that first kid and we tell him the word, we're actually going to give him the object that that word denotes. Meaning, you're going to tell him notebook. Now you're worried that as he whispers the kid to the next kid, the word is going to get distorted and come out elephant at the end of the line. You hand him a notebook and you tell him, whisper notebook and give him the notebook. Now, what are the chances that by the time it reaches the 50th kid, he's still going to say notebook? You've basically solved the problem. Because what's the problem? The problem is that the second kid hears something similar, slightly off. The third kid, a little more slightly off. But if the second kid hears something slightly off notebook, but he's being given a notebook in his hand, he's going to figure out that it's a notebook, right? So if the notebook is being passed from kid to kid, we've already got a pretty good situation. But let's do more than that. Actually have him pass a note that says the word in shorthand. So it's two things he's doing. He's actually giving a live object, right? He's giving the actual thing. He's also passing a paper that says the word. Just in case the kid gets the notebook in his hand and hears tape recorder, it says NTBK on the note. Okay? That's number two. Mechanism number three. Instead of the first kid whispering it to the second kid twice, have him whisper it 50 times. Notebook, 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 notebook. Even if he hears it a little off, 10, 15, 20 times, whisper it 50 times, he'll probably get the word. Mechanism number four. And this is the way to ensure that at the end of the day, how can I verify that it's really that same word? Mechanism number four. Don't have a row of 50 kids, one passing to the next. Have 50 rows of 10 kids. Okay? 10 kids in the first row, whispering the word to 10 kids in the second row, whispering the word to 10 kids in the third row. Okay? So now, if at the end of the day, by the way, they're also handing them the object and the note. If at the end of the day, the guys in the last row are saying the same word, I can be sure that it's the same word. Because even if it gets distorted, it's not going to get distorted on all 10 lines. Right? So if at the end of the day, the 50th row of 10 kids are all saying the same word, we can be a lot sure that that was the first word than if it's just one 50th kid at the end. Everyone following me? Please speak up if you don't get what I'm... That's mechanism number 4. Mechanism number 5. Repeat it for 10 days. Meaning, not just once, one word going to the next kid, but have kid number 1 tell kid number 2 it today, then again tomorrow, then again the next day. For 10 days. So again, it's for 10 days being sent back to 10 different kids. Does that better our chances of making sure that the word will be absorbed right? Next, warn the kids that if this messes up, they're in big trouble. Get a really good punishment. Now they'll be careful. What was it you said? Right? Each kid is going to want to make sure you're right. Did you say notebook? And also tell them that they get a really great prize if it comes out good. That's mechanism number 6. Mechanism number 7 is to really get these kids to understand that what they're doing is of immense value to humanity for some reason. Whatever the case would be in the case of both of them. If you put all these 7 mechanisms together, would you say that we got pretty close to 100% that the word at the end is going to be the same word at the beginning? I think we can bet any amount of money on it. So now let's go back and analyze each of these 7 mechanisms, see how the Torah built that into our messages. Let's go back to the beginning of the second mechanism. First of all, the Messiah goes through in physical form. Part of the Messiah is tefillin. Note, this is very interesting. This is not just an issue of the text being conveyed from one generation to the next, but of Torah Shebaal Peh being conveyed from one generation to the next. Torah says, wear taitafais between your eyes. Anybody know what taitafais are? Would you get from taitafais to the perfect black square with the shin, with the rituis exactly so, etc.? Where does that come from? Each generation handed the actual object to the next, along with the description of what has to be done. That's just one example. Tzitzit, matzah, etc. All these things were being given objects, passed from one generation to the next. They saw how it was done. Tefillin. Very difficult question. How do we account for Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi? The truth is that that's a question, not on what I'm saying, it's a difficult question anyways. Because, we know historically that Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi came, in the worst case, after 1,000 years after people were wearing tefillin. Why didn't they both get together? Right, Rabbi Natan was Rashi's grandson. Both get together, open up Rashi's grandfather's tefillin, see what was there. It's a tough question. I'll give an interesting answer to it. I hope it's substantiable. First of all, the Arizal later said, this is the truth, the Arizal later said that both are actually a part of the Masorah. Meaning that both always were in existence. Apparently what happened was, we don't have clear records of this, because we don't have actual historic account of what happened in Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam's time. Apparently Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, it's not that Rabbeinu Tam or Rashi came along and said, hey, you know what, really we should be doing tefillin differently than it's been done up till today. That's how I come out of the sugya. Apparently, there were two versions in existence, and Rashi was ruling like one, Rabbeinu Tam like the other. And the Arizal said that the truth is that our peace side, each one has its place. And that's why the Arizal was very into wearing both. Sfardim wear both together. So, the Pashat understanding of that is, we want to be yoytze both shitas. The Arizal held that that's not true. You should be wearing both. We certainly won't say that that's the pshat, the chiyuv of al taitapas. But on the side level, both are true. What's that? Apparently, the Arizal would say that either he wore both, or somehow he worked both elements into one pair of tefillin. Maybe when, if you had the proper Kabbalistic understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu, you were able to manipulate both. I don't know. Possibly. Right. And I heard it said, and this I don't know, I can't substantiate this, that they later then discovered two pairs of tefillin in the kever of one of the Nevi'im. Buried. They dug it up, and they found both versions. I don't know. That already, I don't know. I can say what the Arizal said. That's how we identify it today. Now, we talked about the shorthand note. The shorthand note, of course, is Torah Shebikhtav. Let's remember. Let's retain this perspective. It's a very important perspective. According to what we're saying now, our main Torah, our main Yiddishkeit, is a Yiddishkeit that was transmitted by Al-Peh. Yeah, like we said, we're not meant to know about Matan Torah from reading it in the Torah. We're meant to know about it as part of our national memory. Torah Shebikhtav, the purpose of Torah Shebikhtav is mamish that. That's Rav Hirsch puts it. It's the shorthand notes given to anchor all the information which is being conveyed orally. The Torah is oral. That's how Torah is meant to be conveyed. Like the Chazon Ish says it, Torah is meant to be a live transmittal from live Chacham to live Chacham. Torah is meant to be all of Torah is meant to be conveyed live. Just what? In order to help to facilitate the process, Hashem provided us with shorthand notes, which we call Torah Shebikhtav. That's really what Torah Shebikhtav is. Shorthand notes accompanying Torah Shebikhtav. That's why. What's that? Not necessarily. No. Hashem was giving the Torah to Moshe orally. Moshe was writing it and conveying it. Came together. And it came in Torah Shebaal Peh in more detail. I mean, but what happened? Hashem taught Moshe. He wrote it and he gave it over. The Gemara tells us what the process was. Moshe learned it from Hashem. He then came and taught it to Aaron. He then taught it to Aaron along with the Zkenim. Then along with etc. etc. It was an oral transmittal. Just, it was accompanied with notes. What's that? Yeah, it was good. Yeah. So that's as far as giving over the object and giving over the notes. Next, repeat the word 50 times. From the day the Torah was given, Hashem wants, note also that in this Torah we differ from any other nation. It is such a central theme in Torah that everybody should know as much Torah as possible and be studying it as much as possible. That's besides the basic text where we're told you have to say this two times a day, right? Kriya Shema. Yes, we're trying. You have to be saying this two times a day. Hashem wants it to be as a part of our national life, day-to-day life, as the air you breathe. Yes, Mitzrayim, you can't forget those parshas every day, again and again and again and again and again. That's the mechanism of telling the kids, don't tell it to the next kid once, tell it to him 50 times. Right? When we're conveying it, so first of all, Kriya Shema. No mother has a problem saying Shema with her kids by heart. How does she know it by heart? She sat down to memorize it? No. It was banged in good. Bang again and again and again and again. Since she's three, she's saying it. If we're talking about a woman who doesn't daven once a day. Shema, the basics are being hammered in, and the Torah is telling us, spend your life trying to get as much Torah as possible. Hashem wants the Torah to be alive in Klal Yisrael. Hashem doesn't want it just to be available in written form. Hashem wants the Torah to be as widespread in Klal Yisrael as possible. That's like we said before. By us, it always has been a supreme value. Start educating the kids from the earliest possible age. Start hammering it in. Bang it in well. That's how our Masorah works. This is a very, very simple understanding of why Torah is considered the most chashuv of a mitzvah. Because Torah is not just doing it now. Torah is continuing the conveyor belt from one generation to the next. By learning it, you know it. You know it. You're in better position to convey it better. So that's the mechanism of the repetition. Then we have the next mechanism, which is such a powerful point. Instead of having a single file row of kids passing the word from one to the other, have a long line of rows. You have 50 kids in the first row. You tell them all the same words. Tell all those 50 to tell it to the next 50. What's going on with Torah? It's not that we have a straight tradition. We have a million straight traditions. Right? Each father has been teaching it to his kids since the beginning. So it's the same tradition being handed down in so many lines. Right? That's right. We don't want just that there should be a Rebbe in every generation who can teach people. We want there to be many lines of tradition. This is unequal. There's no phenomenon in any other faith. Such a thing. Yeah, in general, the parents know the faith. Okay, fine. But again, like we said, all the other faiths end up funneling up to one person. You don't have something that goes all the way back, begins with a line of 3 million, to a line of 3 million, to a line of 3 million, to a line of 3 million. But it spreads out, right? Right? So, one person adds many kids. Exponential. Next. Repeat the process day after day. It's obvious. Right? Torah is full of repetition. Mitzvahs that have to be done on a regular basis. These mitzvahs are edos. So many of the mitzvahs that we're doing are called edos. What are edos? It's a specific category of mitzvahs. Testimonials. How many mitzvahs do we do that are coming to remind us of fundamentals? Pesach, Sukkah, right? So many mitzvahs are simply edos. Tzitzis, tefillin. All these things are edos. Remember, 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 remember. Right? We're knocking it in day after day after day after day. A few times a day. Repeat it. Next, of course, warn about the dire consequences for any deviation, for any mess up. We were very, very severely warned. Like we saw the Ramban last week. Like the Ramban points out, no mitzvah is expressed that way. The double. Beware and be very careful of your lives, lest you forget everything that you heard. And the immense char. And then, of course, understanding the value of what it is we're doing by conveying our service. Understanding the value. The immense value in passing things from one generation to the other. What's that? You're asking. Oh, you're asking a good question. We're saying that an important part of the Masaira is linked in the fact that we're motivated by the problem of reward, by the promise of reward and punishment. But the most fundamental aspect of our belief, that is Olam Haba, doesn't seem to be a part of it. The answer is, first of all, it's on the contrary. As we just discussed, the main chain of Torah is Torah Shebaal Peh. And Olam Haba was always a part of Torah Shebaal Peh. As we said, Torah Shebiktav are just accompanying notes. Often Torah Shebiktav provides sparse information about what the Torah is, and that's why you can never approach Torah Shebiktav as a way of really figuring out what the Torah is about. Torah Shebiktav is mamish like, we said the other time, taking a notebook from someone who went to attend college, and you take his notebook with shorthand notes, and you read through it, and now you know everything he knows. Person who learns Torah Shebiktav is doing that. Torah Shebiktav are shorthand notes accompanying the tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh. And therefore, that's right. The most one of the most fundamental aspects of Yiddishkeit, which is Olam Haba, is mainly rooted in Torah Shebaal Peh. But it is alluded to in Torah Shebiktav, which already Mamish gives it the same nature as many other aspects of Torah, which get allusions in Torah Shebiktav and have to be elaborated upon in Torah Shebaal Peh. Plenty of examples of this. What's that? Teicha on the curses. I'll get to that. We'll get to that. 1 minute. Well, I don't know if we're going to get to it tonight. But first of all, what is the reason for it? Is a good question that's discussed by the Kadmon. Why is the Torah so sparse in the Torah Shemiksav about providing the information of Olam Haba? Why is it so cryptic? So first of all, we do have to note that there are plenty of references in Torah Shemiksav to Olam Haba, just that they're not noticed. For example, how much more explicit can it get than Bilam, who says, "Tamois nafshi mois yisharim, utihi achrisi kamoyu. May I die the death of the righteous, and may my future, may I have the afterwards that they have." You get more explicit than that? Or more of a direct hint? Just what? It leaves it a question mark. What is the achris? But Bilam is explicitly saying, may I die the death of the righteous and have their afterwards. Okay?
So maybe he was saying that he was under the belief system, not commenting upon the Jewish belief system.
What Bilam said at that time was a nevuah, a prophecy which was being said in light of his revelation from Hashem. He wasn't saying it in a personal conversation. These were, on the contrary, was his personal yearnings which were coming from the force of the nevuah he was seeing. But again, you have to remember that it's in the context of a nevuah, prophecy. That's number one. If you get into other places in Tanakh, it gets even much more explicit than that. Daniel, Pesukim, they talk about Yokitzu v'yiranenu yisheni yofar, the dead will get up and they will cry out enthusiastically. Nosatim l'ocha mahalkim v'noim dimo'ile. Hashem promises Yeshua, it's ben yitzodek ha-kohen ha-godol, promises, I'll give you a place among these angels. So, there's plenty. Just, it's not addressed as a subject in and of itself. The Torah doesn't make a point of discussing it. Why is that? So the Kadmonim give a few good reasons for why that is. If we want, a very profound reason is given by the Kuzari. A little bit off topic here, but nevertheless. Kuzari says, this kind of touches on, this is a little bit of an understanding of what we're missing when we are without a Beis HaMikdash. Kuzari says that the reason that the Torah did not discuss Torah Olam Haba was because we're not meant to have to wait for after death in order to begin experiencing it. We're meant to begin experiencing it in this world. When there was a Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, when we really had the Shekhinah in Klal Yisrael, you were able to tap into Olam Haba in this world by following the Torah's directives. Nevuah, we think of as a technicality. Hashem's got a message. So he taps somebody on the shoulder and he says, can you tell the Jews this and this? Talking. It's like me giving somebody else a message. Nevuah, actually experiencing Hashem, having a personal revelation of Hashem, was Olam Haba in this world. Was experiencing the afterlife in this world. More than that. He says that all the promises of material reward, which the Torah, right? Torah, when it promises reward, only talks about material reward. He says, we take that in the wrong perspective today, because, mamash what we discussed before. We hear, you'll have a lot of food, you'll have a lot of rain, and that's that. That's not the point. The point is, that when you see that your behavior is rewarded with a lot of rain, it creates a live awareness of Hashem's presence in you, amongst you. Meaning, for example, think of it in personal terms. The rain was more than just rain. It's more than just, oh, okay, we have a lot of wheat. Or like we said before, you have wheat that's the size of kidneys. That's not the point. The point is, you felt a kiss from Hashem. You felt Hashem smile. Imagine a person who spent his winter while he was planting his field, spent his winter working hard on improving his Shmiras HaLashon, better about not talking Lashon Hara. That was, put a lot of effort into that throughout the winter. And then, spring arrives, and all of a sudden, the grain that's growing is this big. The wheat grain, the wheat berries are this big. So, can you imagine the thrill that that person is going to feel? Not because, well, great, now I have big wheat berries. But because look at Hashem coming and openly acknowledging his efforts. This was the experience of all the material bracha that they experienced in those times. The Kuzari says they were already living in Olam Haba. They were beginning to experience what Olam Haba is. Olam Haba means living with Hashem in a live way. Feeling Hashem in a live way today, it's all abstract. We have to put in so much effort to try to feel a little bit of a connection with Hashem. In those days, this was how it worked. Interaction. You were able to reach Nevuah, which was Mamish experiencing Olam Haba. Even those who didn't reach Nevuah, everybody was able to. Anybody could work towards it if they wanted to. I made a cheshbon once. If you go with the amount of Nevi'im that they say actually were, we only know of the Nevi'im whose Nevuah had to be recorded for all of history. But there were actually millions of Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. The Gemara gives the number. I once made the cheshbon. It comes out, if we're talking in terms of today, there was a Navi in every third building. It was something that everybody could strive for. A Navi in every third building. More Nevi'im than Rabban. Okay? But even if you did not reach Nevuah, even if you just reached the level that, yes, your spiritual efforts were rewarded with an unnatural bracha, and you saw directly how you were interacting with Hashem in your farm, right? You did this, Hashem rewarded you with that. We're talking about a different quality of life. It's not the fact that, oh, great, we have wheat berries. It's the meaning of it.
So you have a whole community of people that didn't experience Hashem's bracha. So what you're saying makes sense, that there's a person, he was rewarded, he got good berries, and they got his next door neighbor, I think the soil conditions are exactly the same, didn't they? Have a powwow afterwards, and says, you know, I'm not trying to share solutions, you know, I didn't do anything. And then this guy learns that, okay, I need to improve my relationship. We have situations where you have a whole town, you have a whole country of Eretz Yisrael without rain.
Sometimes you're right. Meaning, sometimes it reflected the fact that there was a communal failing, or sometimes the fact that there was a communal success. In the time of Shlomo HaMelech, it was the same thing you're describing, just in the opposite sense. There was so much bracha for everybody. But yet, even at the end of the day, with the fact that rain is an individual thing, and by the way, that Gemara in Tainus also notes that there were sometimes cases where one person's field had rain and the others didn't. Right? Remember that too. But even without that, with rain, which is, yeah, in general, a national or a communal thing, first of all, it could differ from one community to another. That's number one. But number two, there's still plenty of room in a person's personal life. At the end of the day, even if you and your neighbor have rain, you and your neighbor don't have the same exact state in life. There's plenty of room, whether it comes to health, whether it comes to exactly how prosperous your crops are going to grow. Different fields grow differently at the end of the day. It's not all going to be uniform. There's plenty of room for Hashem to have his individual. So it most manifests in the Midbar. But Mamish, your behavior the previous day, you saw that reflected in how far the man was from your door. Right? You tried to rationalize the way you spoke to the neighbor last night. Right? The next morning you woke up, the mom was a little further away, all your rationalizations fell down the tube. But this was going on as long as the Shekhinah was in Yisrael. And on the contrary, the Kuzari says that this was also came through the punishments. The fact that the Jewish people saw that their proper behavior always brought on bracha, and that their misbehavior immediately came, followed by punishments, was the greatest sign of, again, Hashem's closeness to them. The fact that we don't have it that way today is because of Hashem's distance from us. On the contrary, often it's the teichachos that are part of our sense of security. The fact that, like no other nation, averus immediately bring the punishment, hard, fast and hard, can help bolster our sense of security in the fact that we are in good hands. All we have to do, it's up to us to improve. When the nation is up to that level, again, we don't need the Torah to discuss Olam Haba. In fact, the Kuzari says, he ridicules the concept. It's mamish funny. Today we're used to, we relegate Olam Haba to the afterlife. The Kuzari ridicules the concept. He says, what kind of religion? Who comes and says, Christians and the Muslims, they come and tell you, oh, be good now, and at some time when nobody can report about, you'll have good. That's not how the Torah is meant to work. Today it works that way because we're far from the Shechina. The way the Torah is meant to work is, do it and you'll see it now. You don't have to wait. Once you see it now, you can imagine what will be in the afterlife. That's one of the explanations offered of why the Torah doesn't discuss Olam Haba. But again, as we said, Olam Haba is well entrenched in our tradition from the beginning of time. All right, I think we've basically concluded that subject. Move on.